This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to episode 140 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Nearly 7 months after the Israeli-Hamas war began, many campuses across the country are dealing with pro-Palestinian demonstrations and encampments. Some college presidents have chosen to involve the police, which has led to hundreds of students being arrested. In addition, these protests have again stirred up a debate about the limits of free speech, as some think the messaging has become anti-Semitic. Rick, your campus has not had any of these large-scale protests, but I know you've been thinking about the ethics behind such efforts elsewhere. In fact, you've come up with a list of four things you say ethically justified protests must have, and I think that's a good place to start our discussion today.
Yeah, could I preface this a little bit?
Please.
I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I had a really good colleague when I was teaching at Christian Brothers University in Memphis who was teaching courses on nonviolence. We used to have regular discussions about nonviolence. We were also located in the same building as the Arun Gandhi Center for Nonviolence. Arun Gandhi is the nephew of Mahatma Gandhi.
Okay.
And so we were having these kinds of discussions all the time. And of course, Memphis is the place where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated and has the King Museum. And during all this, Tennessee, along with some other states, reinstituted the death penalty after it had been put in abeyance for many years. And there were some regular protests. And my colleague was leading some of these protests in downtown Memphis that went on for years. They would stand on a certain corner near downtown Memphis where that was really visible to protest
this. And this was around the death penalty reinstitution, correct?
Yes, right. And so I just wonder, like, this isn't something I just came up with recently.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this for a long time because one of the things that happens when you study the history of protests, and especially the way in which protests were conducted under the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. and others who were like really heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, realize how much thought there was behind how the protests were done, how much education there was of the people who, long preparation and training. Somebody like Rosa Parks was a member of a group who were meeting. They were praying regularly and planning for what they would do. It wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing.
Yeah, sort of the myth of Rosa Parks is she just woke up one morning and decided this, and that's not the case.
That's not the case at all. And yet, during these most recent protests, and I would say also the protests after the murder of George Floyd, there were quite a few protests on college campuses. Talking with my students then and now during the protests on campuses regarding what is happening in Palestine, it became clear to me that my students, and I think this is true of most college students, have very little education in the history of protests, what make effective protests. They don't have a good understanding of what civil disobedience is. They are familiar with the words, and Ross Douthat wrote about this in the New York Times just recently. Even universities like Columbia, which is a great book school, with the liberal arts education has some really robust readings in classical literature and philosophy that's pretty well-rounded until you get to the 20th century. And then it's all strictly kind of very progressive left-wing mostly criticisms of capitalism and often of democracy, any kind of institutions, but very little focus on the sorts of things that you might read if you are looking at, like, what are the books that Martin Luther King would have read? What are the books that Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi, what influenced them? Anyway, so I say all this as preface, like, this is the kind of perspective I'm bringing to this. I don't think our universities have done a good job, and I think that's made these protests kind of hard to understand and frankly, very unsympathetic to a lot of Americans.
And like I said, I think we'll get into a lot of those issues as the show unfolds here. But maybe a good place to start would just be discussing those four points you think about ethically, principles of ethical protesting, and I'll just let you take them in whatever order you'd like.
Okay. Well, the first one is that the protest should have a just cause. That might seem really obvious, but of course it's the number one condition. And I think for many people, you'd say, well, the civil rights, protesting Jim Crow laws in the South, the rights to, that was obviously a just cause. Of course, it wasn't just to everybody. A lot of people in the South didn't think that it was a just cause, but many people did. And the point of it was revealing the injustice of the laws that were in existence. That's the case here with these protests. Like, do they have a just cause? And the challenge is then revealing and making clear that it is.
And I just want to pause on that for a second, because I certainly was not around for those protests in the 1960s, but you're right that they were a just cause, but they also, I think, were pretty easy to understand. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like the issues were extremely simple, but I think it was something you could pretty much capture in a couple sentences. And, you know, you may have people who may not agree with you, but I think it was not difficult to explain the issue. And talking about the campus protests today, where you have this Palestinian and Israeli conflict that's been, well, in the news since October in big, big ways, but it has been going on for hundreds of years before, I'm not convinced that the people who are doing the protesting are really as well informed on this issue as they could be. And unlike maybe some of the issues in the 1960s, it's really complicated, right?
It is very complicated. And I don't think the cause is well articulated. There are groups supporting many of the students who are participating in these protests right now on these campuses. In fact, they're paying internships to some of the students who are organizers on some campuses. That are, if you look at their literature, they're calling for revolution. I mean, they're deeply ingrained in a kind of an anti-capitalist, anti-democratic rhetoric. And so then you start to ask, well, exactly what is the cause? Is the cause a ceasefire? Is it the elimination of Israel? Is it more humanitarian aid? I'm not sure what it is. And this leads right into my second point, is that the protests must have clear and obtainable goals. And so what are those goals? And the one we hear most frequently from the protesters is they want divestment of college portfolios in any companies that are doing business with Israel.
And I guess a couple of thoughts. One, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that most of these protests, not all, are happening at private colleges, and private colleges don't make that information public about where their investments are in many cases. Is that how you understand it?
That's pretty standard. They're not going to make that public, but they're also, like, a lot of the investments might be in index funds.
Oh, absolutely.
They're distributed. And these companies, there are 430 major multinational companies doing business in Israel. They're the companies that are producing things like Intel and NVIDIA. They're producing, our chips that are running our computers.
It's
companies like Hewlett Packard, you know, makes a lot of laptops, Apple. I mean, and so I question whether the goals of the protesters are, first of all, whether they're clearly articulated in their own minds. Do they understand that what they're asking for is the removal of investments in companies that make the very tools that they're using to carry out the protests, right? Because they're using social media, they're using Microsoft software. So first of all, it's not even clear that if these universities wanted to divest from those companies that they could. And I'm sure that's why Columbia just said yesterday, they just said, no, we're not going to do that. We're open to talking about other things. But it's not even clear that this is actually what the students want. For example, would they, I mean, if it becomes really clear to them, are they also going to say, okay, and then we're also personally divesting from these companies. We're not going to use iPhones or Microsoft or HP or any of these. I don't think that's the case. So I don't think this has been clearly thought through.
Go. What's your third on your list? What's your third point, Rick?
The third point is ethical protests must use persuasion and not coercion as the means of obtaining their goals. So this rules out things like forcible occupation of buildings, harassment, or
the swarming of highways to stop traffic is used as well in larger cities.
Anything that is aggressively pushing your agenda on others, because what it does is it's actually counterproductive. So it's a questionable tactic in its own right of whether using that means is ethical, but it's also, it just doesn't work. Bill Maher said the other night, do you realize that these tactics just make people dislike you, right? And that's not what you want to do in a protest. You're trying to win people over to your cause. So you're trying to make your side appear more sympathetic and more reasonable. And what you're actually doing is you're making people not just dislike you, but really suspect your motives and your character.
And we've certainly had plenty of coverage in news outlets over the past couple of weeks about these protests. And we're talking about these protests. However, at sometimes that is at the expense of actually covering what's going on right now in the Middle East. And I think am I right to think that if the news is about your protest and not actually what you're protesting and showing the atrocities, you know, thousands of miles away, have you in effect sort of lost the message here?
Yes. And this is what happens with a lack of really strong and clear-sighted leadership. This is why it was so important, for example, for the civil rights movement, for the liberation of India, for example. I mean, Gandhi and King and Nelson Mandela in South Africa, they were always talking about and writing about what their aims were, and they were always reminding the followers that, like, and this is how we're doing it, step by step. And the reason they were doing that is to keep the focus and connecting the means of the protest to the goal that they're trying to accomplish. And that's really hard to do. And what happens if you don't have that kind of leadership that's reminding everybody involved of what the message is, you keep trying to amp up the level of energy. And so, like, just today, we're recording this on a Tuesday, and we get reported that a bunch of Columbia students just forcibly entered and occupied one of the buildings, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
Right. And every time this sort of thing that happens, I mean, they're rewarded, I guess, with more media attention. But that's all media attention that isn't going to what's happening in Gaza. And you would think, well, isn't there a real objective to get people to actually focus on what's going on instead of ignoring what's going on in Gaza?
And you, a number of times during this discussion, you know, contrasted it to the civil rights demonstrations in the 1960s. And I think we can probably agree that although those protests may not have been the only reason we had some significant law changes in this country and significant attitude changes in this country, those protests were a large factor in those changes. Would you agree?
Absolutely, and they changed public opinion.
Yeah,
right.
But to me, though, I wonder if these protests today are somewhat more analogous to this protest that were happening again in that same era around the Vietnam War. And because that was about foreign policy decisions that were being made not only overseas, but also by the U.S. government. And I think, and obviously that was very, especially for young people at that time, an especially pressing issue because either they might or they certainly knew some of their peers who were going over to Vietnam, serving, and sometimes not coming back. And that was a real issue for them that faced them front and center. That's not happening, obviously, in the Middle East right now. But do you see any comparison to what some of the tactics that were used in some of those protests against the Vietnam War? Is there anything similar, or do you think those protests were maybe more aligned to these principles that you talk about today?
No, I think those many of the anti-war protests were very similar to what's going on today, because they were very different in character depending on where the protests were going on. Some of them were quite violent.
Mm-hmm.
They also got mixed up with all kinds of other kind of social goals and had a range of behaviors. They often weren't very sympathetic. They only became really sympathetic to the public when police or National Guard overreacted.
Yeah, Kent State was an example.
A great example. And we find the same thing. If you watch the videos of police officers arresting students and faculty at Emory University in Atlanta, that was a clear overreaction. One of the faculty members who was tackled, and then her hands were zip tied and she was taken away and arrested, was clearly, if you watch the whole video, she's just walking across campus and then was not engaged in the protests at all. And so then you think, then you get kind of some sympathetic response towards the protesters. But it's not because of what the protesters are doing. It's because we naturally, you know, you watch things like that. And if you're kind of a neutral party observing it, you're going to side with the people that you think are innocent in some case if there's some wrongdoing take place. And so I think in some ways, similar to the Vietnam protests, they aren't very effective in their own right. They're only effective insofar as they provoke an overreaction.
And I think I have some other points I want to cover on this, but before I bring us to those points, we should probably get to your fourth tenet of ethical protests, and that is?
That is that the protest be grounded in truth. And this means that the protests themselves must use truthful speech. They must make sure that what they are talking about, the facts they're sharing and so forth, are truthful, that they're accurate, that they're grounded in reality. And the reason this is important for as an ethical condition of protest is based on something that Hannah Arendt said. She wrote an essay called Truth in Politics in 1967. Where she talked about factual truth being the way we get our bearings. And it's the condition of having meaningful and lasting political changes. The only changes that are going to be lasting in your political changes are the ones that correspond to what's really going on in the world. And so you have the protests have to be truthful.
Covering some other things that have sort of been talked about around this issue over the past couple of weeks, there has been, I remember hearing somebody say, and I don't know if you agree or not, but that being a college president has got to be one of the worst jobs out there because you're dealing with things like this while also trying to keep your schools on the correct academic path. And oh, by the way, you're also on the phone constantly trying to raise money for your institution. Maybe one of the questions I have sort of around that is there have been a number of people in Robert Kraft, who is I think probably a billionaire who owns the New England Patriots and other businesses, had been a regular and a regular donor to Columbia, and said because of how the school has handled this, he's going to stop making donations because of that. How much do you think colleges and college administrators should care about things like that? Because clearly, they, in a lot of ways, have a business to run, and that is not their only source of revenue, but it's a significant part. And when they start hearing from people with deep pockets who have been longtime enthusiastic supporters, that's got to get their attention. How do you think that sits ethically, though?
Well, I think they should be paying attention to them, but there, of course, there's a lot of people they should pay attention to them, and that those are, you know, those are some of the really important stakeholders in the university, and they're contributing. And somebody like Robert Kraft, I think he's given $50 million or something.
A lot of money.
A lot of money. Now, it shouldn't be the only consideration. I don't even know if it's a primary consideration, but it's one of the things to listen to them.
But I bet if you're a protester and you hear that, that's not going to soothe you. That's going to make you even more upset, right? Because universities are listening to their rich, big pocket donors and not to the students on the out there making noise. I mean, that's clearly, I would imagine, going to anger the protesters even more.
Well, are they angered when they're receiving scholarships from that donor? Are they angered when they're going to classes from taking classes from an endowed professor whose salary is paid by that donor? Or
in nice buildings that have been funded by.
Absolutely. And so there's sometimes a failure to appreciate the extent to which the protesters themselves are using a platform that's been, to a large extent, created by the donors. I mean, this whole campus, much of it has been built and constructed in the very conditions of their education made possible by the donors. Now, that doesn't mean that donors have the final say in everything that happens, but it is why, it's the president's responsibility to oversee the whole thing, which includes making sure that the university have a clear mission and they follow the mission, especially when it comes to controversial things. And I think that many of these presidents have created serious problems for themselves by not having a clearly articulated mission and not making critical decisions with reference to that mission. And so then when, you know, for example, it's been pointed out for quite some time that there's been real differences in treatment of political viewpoint when it comes to allowing protests of speakers, especially over the last several years. Now, some universities have not. They've had really clear principles by which they allow students to kind of disrupt proceedings or prevent speakers from coming to campus and other where they don't and say, these are the rules. Those universities generally are not experiencing these protests, and nobody's calling for the firing of those presidents.
Another tough decision those college leaders have to make, and I think from all the reading I've done, it's been in many cases a difficult decision, is when and whether to call law enforcement in. Obviously, there have been some universities that have had to make arrests. It's also, the universities like to point out that not everyone who is part of the protests and who is being arrested are students, although I think in most cases, certainly the majority of people there are students. I think there are some outside actors as well. But it seems to me that's not the only lever those college administrators have to pull. Do you think they're using that at the right time?
No. I mean, if they have a policy against encampments, then you don't say, okay, we let the encampments go until they get out of control or until they become really disruptive. You have a policy against that. You don't let them start. And then you don't call on the police because it doesn't take many people to keep an encampment from starting. And so many of these places, like Columbia is one, UCLA is another, where the encampments have been in place for a long time. It's clearly they did not know how to respond to the camel sticking its nose under the tent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's frankly unfair towards law enforcement to bring them in to be the bad guys at a time when things have gotten really out of control. This should not be law enforcement's job to come onto a campus and get control over the students of that very campus. That there's something deeper that's gone wrong if that's what you have to resort to.
Scott Galloway, who is a professor in New York and also Jewish, has been fairly outspoken the past week or two. One thing he said that I'll be curious about your feedback on is that he says that we should give young people a bit of latitude to express beliefs that are probably not exceptionally well thought out. And certainly when things go violent and when there's hate speech involved, there are certainly ways that things can go too far. But part of the college experience is to sort of let people, young people, figure this out and kind of see what fits for them and have these conflicts, I guess, amongst themselves in peaceful and hopefully productive ways. What he says is very different, though, is how some of the professors have acted on this. And he believes that some of the statements that some professors at these universities have made are really fireable offenses, where they have come out and said things that not only maybe incite some of the actions that are happening on these campuses, but say things that he would consider to be very anti-Semitic and hateful towards the Jewish community, which, again, he's part of. But a lot of what he has said, I really kind of tend to agree with, but I'd be curious. I know I shared some of those clips with you, and if you had any thoughts about that as well.
Over the past 4 years, we've seen a number of firing of faculty for making what were claimed to be racist statements,
mm-hmm.
Especially racist statements directed or seemingly directed against people of color. Some of those have turned out to be probably not racist at all, but ambiguous statements that could be interpreted in that way or regarded as insensitive. But there was no latitude at all given to many people regarding certain forms of hate speech. But when it came to anti-Semitic remarks and even remarks that may be questionable, but my view is pretty clearly it was hate speech. There seems to be all of a sudden all kinds of latitude. And this is part of, I think many people have pointed out, the double standard that has taken place on many campuses. And I think he's exactly right. I think you have to decide what you are going to do. And if hate speech is a fireable offense, for some, it's a fireable offense no matter who that hate speech is directed towards. And especially when you have faculty members who themselves are provoking really disruptive kinds of activities, and their focus is not on helping students to learn and achieve an education, but to accomplish political goals. And I don't think the purpose of a university is to become an actor in the political realm. I think the purpose of the university is to prepare people with the kind of knowledge and the habits necessary to participate in a democracy, and so that you can have a really well-informed and engaged citizenry that are participating in politics. But I don't think it's the university's role to do that. But yet we have many faculty who think so, who think that like universities ought to take political stances. I just think that's wrong. And so I agree with him. Yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Last thing before we leave this issue, Matt Iglesias wrote a piece, I guess, late last month that it was maybe a slight bit tongue-in-cheek, but said that part of the reason that these protesting, or these protests show, I guess he was would say, that we're just simply not giving students enough academic stuff to do, that we're not maybe being as rigorous as we could be, and that maybe if we had higher expectations, assigned more homework, they would find themselves busier doing those things. I heard another argument, however, that said, if you're a student who's maybe not leading the charge on this, right, but you're sort of watching and observing and maybe participating in very small ways, that is this maybe not more of a learning experience for you that you might remember than some art history class that you may forget all about? So I guess, where do you come down on maybe both sides of that issue?
I had an art history class that was one of the best classes I had as an undergraduate, and I still remember it, like, so many details from that, and it's been like it was just, it opened my eyes to all kinds of things.
Well, I'll take that. So let's reframe.
I'm going to protest you're using art history as an example of of wasted education. You can learn from all kinds of things, and I'm sure that many of the experiences these students are going through are going to be quite memorable, and they're going to learn quite a bit. I think they could learn a lot more. And I think in universities, as I said, we should be teaching them about protests and how do you participate in a democracy in which you have people with different understanding of events and who care deeply and sincerely about how we act as a group, say as a nation, or within our organization, and you have deep differences of opinion. How do you work that out, and how should we work it out, and what's acceptable means of doing that? I think we should be talking about all those things, and I think these protests provide a great occasion for doing it.
But do you buy the fact that if professors were just assigning more homework and harder tests and grade inflation weren't such a problem, stem some of this?
That was a really bad... I really like Matthew Duglacius, but that was a bad argument. For one thing, he's pointing back to the days like in the 1960s when universities were assigning a lot more work, and yet they were still out protesting the Vietnam War. By the way, these protests always seem to take place in April. Isn't that amazing?
That was my last thing I was going to ask, because this, you know, as we know, this whole focus on Gaza and Israel began in October. Not that that's forever ago, but that's been a while. And do you think there's any, I mean, two things. One, the weather's nicer. It's easier to protest in the springtime than in January in most parts of this country. And two, finals are coming up just around the corner. Do you think that has anything to do with this?
I think it's very revealing that, for example, you have encampments going on year-round in California, right? But mm-hmm. not in New York. But in New York, they really take shape in April. I don't think the finals have anything to do with it, but I do think that the weather has something to do with it. And it's very revealing when you listen to interviews with students who are engaged in the protests, the things they're talking about. They're talking about how they really loved it. Like, it'll be the first time that they felt a real sense of purpose, like they were contributing to something bigger than themselves, that they felt this real belonging with the other protesters.
Which is something you usually think is great.
And I do think it's great. I mean, those things are really good. And it is true that we tend to have a much greater sense of belonging and affinity for people when we're engaged in a common enterprise that's purposeful. And this provides all of that for them. I'm just not clear that these particular protests are justified according to these other criteria I was laying out. That's not to say I don't think we should be bringing attention to what's going on in Gaza. I think it's really awful what's going on there, and I'm not happy with the American government's response to this. And yet, I don't think these protests are accomplishing anything. I think they're largely a feel-good activity for the students, and that's not what they should be. They should be, like, if they're serious about these, and I think their intentions are sincere, they should be not concerned just with their intentions, they should be concerned with the outcomes. And we know that it's very easy for protests like this to become counterproductive. We saw it with the campus protests and the riots that took place in many cities following the murder of George Floyd. You saw a lot of support for these efforts in the first 2 weeks, and then after they became more disruptive and more violent, support just dwindled rapidly. And so I'm afraid the same thing is happening here, and which shows a kind of thoughtlessness that's unfortunate.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, here is my question for you. We were on vacation last week, and I struck up a conversation with a gentleman who we got to know a little bit where we were staying. And this is something that happened to him. And he told us the story. And I could tell when he told the story, he was unsure whether he did the right thing. So I thought I would get your take. In his case, he was out walking, and we were all visiting this city. I mean, so we know it a bit, but not terribly well. And he was just out walking down the sidewalk, and a woman pulls out of a driveway and pulls right into the center panel of a vehicle and causes some damage. I mean, he said the car certainly was still drivable, but there was damage, very visible. And the woman quickly stopped the car, got out, looked over, saw him approaching, and asked, "Is this your car?" And he said, "No, it's not my car." But, you know, and I guess she thought he was approaching it possibly to drive off. And then as soon as she learned it was not his car, she quickly got back in her car and drove off. He said he wasn't exactly sure what to do. And as he was sort of deciding what to do, they kind of coincidentally, there was a police officer maybe a block away kind of approaching. So he flagged the officer down. And by the time he explained what was going on and what was happening, the person had, you know, the car had disappeared down the road. And so he was like, "Well, I don't know if anything will ever happen to that," but he just worried that maybe he should have done more. And my thought to him was, well, I mean, you were on foot. I don't know. I mean, I guess here's sort of the questions. One, would it have been, if you had any inkling that she was going to do that, would you have said, "Yeah, that is my car," just to keep her around a little longer? And two, would you, again, if you had an inkling that she might be wanting to leave the scene quickly, would you have pulled out your camera and tried to take a picture of her and or her vehicle and tried to document that some way for police? So those are, I guess, the first two questions for you.
Yes, well, because something very like this happened to me when I was a graduate student, and you
were the observer, not the driver.
I was the observer, and it's very similar to this.
And did you post your cell phone camera?
I did not have a cell phone at the time, but the person got out, looked at the damage, got back in their car, and started driving away. And I thought, that's odd, because as soon as the person got out, I thought, well, they were going to stop and they were going to leave a note on the driver's window, something like that, and started to drive away. So I just memorized the license plate. I called the police and reported it.
And kind of just left it at that.
Left it at that. A couple months later, I get called to court to be a witness. The judge was shocked that I actually showed up.
Okay.
I thought I had to, and it turned out most people don't, I guess. I was living in Baltimore, and this had happened in Baltimore City. The court was located in the county on one of the suburbs, and so the judge turned to the defendant in this case, said, "How much money do you have on you?" The poor guy pulls out his wallet, says, $9. The judge says, "Give it to Mr. Kite for his trouble in coming to the court today."
And so I guess you wish you would have had $200.
Yeah, I mean, I'm standing way in the back, yeah. You know, and so the guy says, "Right now?" And the judge says, "Yeah, hurry up." He comes back and he starts taking some money out of his wallet, and he holds back $1, and he just whispers to me, "Can I keep a dollar to ride home on the bus?"
And you said?
Of course you can. And I felt embarrassed for him. But this is, yeah, I think it is an ethical issue. But mainly because you have to ask the question, if you are the owner of the parked car, mm-hmm. what would you want somebody to do?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little different when you're in a city with which you're unfamiliar. And it's also different because now we all have cell phones, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you even have a cell phone in this Baltimore situation? Did you call later when you were around a phone?
I was inside my apartment building, really close by happened.
Okay.
And I just happened to be looking out the window I saw this it was a truck sideswiping, and he actually sideswiped about three cars,
gotcha.
Knocked their mirrors off.
So you could quickly call though from your house phone.
Yeah, but the main thing, I just looked down at the license plate and just wrote it down so I could remember it.
Just to kind of tease out a couple of different scenarios, if for whatever reason you were out. I'm trying to think of a way this would make sense. I was thinking if you were out driving without a cell phone, but I don't know if this still makes sense. Would you ever follow the person?
No.
I guess I'm not sure what that would come to.
I would avoid any kind of personal confrontation because I wouldn't know, like what's going on with that person.
And again, like I asked this person we were vacationing with, saying, "Do you regret not saying that was your car? Because that might, then you could have at least gotten her information." That's sort of quick thinking that would require, that might, most people might not have, but would you consider doing that?
No, I think this is kind of sitcom territory. This is what creates all these like impossible scenarios where people get themselves deeper and deeper into trouble, right? You start out with some little lie or some little deception. And you don't know where that's going.
And you end up being tied up in the back of a ship on the way to South Africa.
Or you're collecting her information, and then the owner of the car walks up, and then you have to explain why you're collecting this person's information. And like, you don't want to do that.
So that'd be bad advice.
I might say, it's not my car, but are you going to call this in?
Mm-hmm.
I might just ask
or I'd be happy to, call it in for you while we're standing here.
Yeah.
So the only time I was ever involved in something like this years ago was I was at a four-way stop, and the person in front of me didn't realize it was a four-way stop, went through the intersection, collided with someone, again, nobody, not to injure anyone, but certainly to cause some damage to both vehicles, and then quickly took off. And I did the same as you. I got the license plate number, and it was, what type of car it was. And at the time, I don't remember if I had a cell phone at the time. So I don't know if I called it in right away, but I know what the corner was, and it was only like four blocks from my office. So I may have waited until I got back there. I don't remember. But I called it in, and then like 24 hours later, I called back because I was curious if they found the person. So I followed up and said, "Hey, I never even considered being called to court like you were in your case, and I certainly never was." But they said, "Yeah, in fact, this person, they got the information quickly, and then they were able to apprehend him within like a mile of the site along another busy stretch." So I'm like, "Well, I felt good about that versus you know, he got away. But so I guess maybe the last question would be, would you ever, especially if it was in the city in which you live, not place you were vacationing, would you ever want to follow up or would you really care?
No, I wouldn't really care.
Okay.
I mean, I would mainly hope that whoever owned the damaged car was able to get reimbursement for it. And no, I wouldn't care about it. It would depend, I guess, on how much damage and how intentional, because technically that's hit and run, isn't it?
Yeah, this was a hit and run. I mean, it certainly was. I mean, this was a collision at a, both cars were moving, and I don't know if that legally, if that's different than striking a parked car, I don't know. But
yeah,
clearly there was a, you know, he ran a stop sign and that's what happened. So yeah, so but but to me, I was just curious to learn, like, to see if justice was served, and that was important to me. But I guess, but not to you.
I guess I would just assume in a case like that, they've got the license plate information. They're gonna
follow up,
and find it.
And the one time, and when I was 17, which is probably when you're the least good driver in your life. That was when I pulled out on a busy road, made a left-hand turn in front of a pickup truck and caused a crash. But I promise you it wasn't a hit and run because I broke my collarbone and could not have run very quickly. So I was stuck right where I was and actually got a ride to the hospital, in fact.
By the pickup?
By the ambulance.
By the ambulance,
by the ambulance. So that was mine. So the one time I caused a crash, I promise you I got to talk to the police.
Was this the small town where you lived?
Well, it was a town I grew up in, about 50,000 people.
Did you know the person?
I did not, although it's funny you mentioned that. There is a service for listeners who don't know called newspapers.com, which is not every local newspaper participates in this. My hunch is that well more than half do. And I have a subscription to this, and anybody can get a subscription to it. But you can keyword search anything on there. And of course, you often need to narrow it down. You can narrow it down by publication, narrow it down by date, all sorts of filters. And when I first got my subscription, there were all sorts. I was just like, I spent like a weekend just like looking at all sorts of things. And that occurred to me. And I actually found the, and I think at the time, the local newspaper in this city ran like a 2 cent, like kind of like a police report. And it was like, I got the name of the person who I struck and who I might've totaled this truck. I don't know. And of course this would have been 30 years ago at this point. And I was like, well, I'm not going to look him up, but I suppose it's too late to say I'm sorry. But it was like, I'm here. I was like, curious. I wonder if he ever thinks about that. Cause I felt a little bad, you know, all these years later.
Yeah. Still misses that truck.
He might. Maybe that was like his all-time favorite truck. And every time he drives down Hastings Way in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and actually I should point out many years later, they did put a stoplight at that intersection. So
it wasn't really your fault. It needed a stoplight.
Well, usually stoplights, they check crash data. And I may have been one of the people that caused that stoplight to be put in. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to The Ethical Life wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics. And this week talks about many of the issues we discussed earlier about the protests. And that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.